gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival for our Wednesday night program on the first day of March, year of our Lord, 2017. Our guest tonight, James Corbett, should be calling in from Japan in about 20 minutes, right after the first break. In the meantime, we'll talk about the markets a little bit and make a few other comments, and James should be here, like I say, in about 20 minutes. Gold was up $1.20 today, $1,250 per ounce, and that's pretty good. That was probably a remarkable performance given that the Dow Jones was up 300 points, actually 303. We would normally expect if the Dow Jones jumped that much, 300 points to another record high, we could normally expect that that gold would go down today. It didn't go up very much, but it did go up. Right? $1.20, it did not go down. We could have expected a $5 or $10 slide. It's up $1.20. We can speculate as to why that's so. I think the reason is that despite what we see in the markets, we had a big bump today in the markets thanks to Mr. Trump's speech, President Trump. Despite that, there's still a growing and a strengthening demand for gold that is not going to be easily impressed by changes in the stock market. I think it shows when the gold continued to go up today, even though the market went up dramatically, I think it gives us a hint that the demand for gold is strengthening, that the gold investors are increasing in confidence, that they are not panicking and selling their gold the first time the stock market moves 50 points one direction, or 50 points up in particular. It's cause for a certain amount of encouragement for people who own gold or plan to buy gold. Silver was up 10 cents today to $18.49 a pound. Platinum was down 8 bucks. $1,019 an ounce, and palladium was up $6, $779 per ounce. And the crude oil was down 9 cents today to $53.74 a barrel. U.S. dollar index was up 0.19 to 101.92. And then we get into the paper markets, and the Dow Jones, as we said, was up 303 points today to 21,115, another record. Well, it popped up over 21,000. Certainly impressive, a great day for Dow Jones. But we'll talk about that. Let me go through a couple more, and then we'll get back to the Dow Jones. NASDAQ was up almost 79 points today to 5,904. New York Stock Exchange was up 149 to 11,661. Standard & Poor's 500 is up 32 points to 2,395, almost 96. 2,396. Dow Jones is up 300 points today, 303 actually. They've had a string of record highs for almost 2 weeks. I think there may have been one day in the 2 weeks where they didn't get another consecutive record high. And maybe they've had 13, even 14 record highs. If not, they've had consecutive record highs. If not, they've had something like 11 or 12 consecutive record highs. Maybe one day down. Today is another record high. The point is, lots of people are delighted by the Dow Jones average. Well, lots of people are piling on right now. And the thing to bear in mind, when we get consecutive record highs like this, this is nearly a record. They may have actually set a new record. If not, they came close to setting a new record for the number of consecutive highs. And the thing to bear in mind is fundamental investment strategy is the contrarian investment strategy, which simply says you buy low and you sell high. Now, it's not contrarian to buy low and sell high. That just may, if you want to make money on your investments, that's just the fundamental reality of the world. All right, you're going to buy something for $1,000 in hopes of selling it for $2,000. Make a $1,000 profit. Or selling it for $1,500 or selling it for $1,100 and make a $100 profit. But you buy low and you attempt to sell higher for a higher price. Hopefully, you have sense enough to know when something is very low and it's actually worth more. You look at it and say, they're selling that for $1,000, but I'm telling you, I think I can sell it for $1,500. So you buy it, you pay $1,000, and then you find the guy who wants to pay $1,500 for it. You make a $500 profit. Buy low, sell high, standard strategy throughout the world ever since time began. But the contrarian investing philosophy emphasizes that it's not just, what are the characteristics when you buy low and you sell high? If you're going to buy low, you're going to buy when everyone else is selling. And the contrarian philosophy says you're doing the opposite of what the crowd is doing. If everybody's selling, now's the time to buy because the price is going to be low, assuming you have solid fundamentals to begin with. You've got a product. You can't just buy a piece of junk because someone's giving it away for next to nothing and hope to sell it. You've got to have something that does have value. You've got to be able to recognize that value. But you buy low, and the reason you are able to do so successfully is because virtually everyone else thinks it's going lower. All right, they said, this is stupid. Don't buy that. That's going to fall. That's by the value. That's going to fall. And then you sell high. And how do you know that it's high? How do you know you've hit that? Well, you get that when everybody says buy, 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 that's the time to run and hide. Get out, get out, get out, at least in the contrarian strategy for investing. All right? So you're going to do opposite of what the crowd is doing at any given time. Now, typically, a decent market, a good market, a stable market, you've got about a 50-50 split. You've got about 50% of the investors are willing to buy a particular product at a particular price, and about 50% are willing to sell. About half think it's going up, about half think it's going down. The price is being discovered, and it's being more or less set, and the price can be expected to be fairly stable because it's a 50-50 division. Half say up, half say down. Okay, balances out. We have a certain amount of stability there. It may not last for more than a day or a week or a month, but for the moment, we have stability. When we get to circumstances where 70% say buy and 30% say sell, chances are the 30% are right. When we get to circumstances where 70%, if we get there, that say sell and 30% say buy, 30% are probably right. Right? You can judge by the percentage of people that are supporting the buy or sell reaction at any given time. That gives you a clue. All right? Should I buy? Should I sell? Well, if most of them say sell, now's a good time to buy. If most of them say buy, now's a good time to sell. When we see that the Dow Jones is sitting at consecutive record highs, almost 2 weeks of them, of consecutive record highs, at least 11, maybe 12, maybe 13. I don't know the number exactly. That's a pretty good indication that everyone, or at least a significant majority, is saying buy, 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 buy. And if you subscribe to the contrarian investment strategy, that gives you a good clue that now is the time if everybody is, well, it's not everybody, but the majority, a significant majority, is saying buy. It's not 50-50. All right? It's 70-30 or 65-35, something along those lines, maybe even higher. If you see that, that may be an indication that now is the time to bail. Get out. Because almost certainly, but with these consecutive highs, record highs, they're probably pointing to a correction. And almost everybody in the marketplace agrees that we're due for a significant correction. Almost everyone recognizes that possibility. Almost everyone looks at the market, and they say, why is the Dow Jones at consecutive record highs? What fundamentals drive that rise? What fundamentals will support that rise for another week or another month or another year? Is the economy that much stronger? Has the debt disappeared? Is unemployment dramatically reduced? What's making the markets move that high? And as near as I can see, and as near as most people can see, it's President Trump. His speech today had, Trump has had a dramatic effect on the market since the moment he was elected. And it's been up and up and up based on public confidence, public optimism that's been inspired by President Trump. And that's all to the good. But is it something that can be sustained? At what point do we reach a point, at what point do we have to recognize that the markets are not, no matter how, you may love President Trump, but nevertheless, is he alone sufficient? Does he have enough force to keep that market high and high and higher and higher and higher? Or is there going to be a moment when we find out that despite Mr. Trump's promises and pledges to accomplish certain things in the economy and in terms of global politics and whatever, and many of which sound great, what happens when we find out that they are more easily said than done? And that's the reality of it. There's a lot of things that Trump wants to do. For example, he wants to cut taxes on corporations, and he also, in his speech, he said he was going to have massive tax cuts for the middle class and significant tax cuts for corporations. And he also wants to spend $1 trillion on rebuilding our infrastructure. Well, how can we cut taxes and also increase spending? He wants to increase one of the biggest increases, if not the biggest peacetime increase in the military, $54 billion. How are we going to cut taxes on corporations and cut taxes on the middle class and still come up with the money for the military? Where are we going to find the revenue to rebuild the infrastructure? Sooner or later, these questions are going to be faced, they're going to be asked, and people are going to sit back and say, wait a second. Turns out that Mr. Trump is merely a chief executive. He is not a magician. All right? He is a chief executive, and there are certain restraints on what executives can do. If you don't have the money, you can't proceed. And we are in a situation, we talk about it on this program on a regular basis, where the debt is so great, can't be paid. And it may be far greater than the government admits officially. I mean, there is more than a little bit of reason, and there is growing number of people who believe that the real national debt is closer to $100 trillion than $20 trillion. And there's some that think that really by the time you get done with all the unfunded liabilities, it's actually closer to $200 trillion than $20 trillion. $20 trillion is what they admit to. But almost certainly the real national debt's 5 times greater, and it could be 10 times greater. That information, that reality is going to restrict what Donald Trump's able to do in the White House. He's going to face a problem sooner or later that he can't raise taxes without slowing the economy. Where's he going to get the money to spend on infrastructure and so on? And as that awareness grows, people realize, Mr. Trump cannot make things happen just by presto changeo. Right? Can't wave his magic wand and all of a sudden things happen. It's wonderful that he's inspiring public confidence. It's wonderful that he's inspiring public optimism. And it's undoubtedly true. Given enough optimism, given enough confidence, we can make good things happen in this country. But it's also true that there are limits on what can be done. In large measure, from my perspective, because we're dealing with this debt-based monetary system. And as long as we have all of that debt, as long as we're dealing with all of that debt, I don't think we're going to be able to... Mr. Trump is not going to be able to walk out of this mess in a magical way. He's caught in the same swamp that engulfed Obama. He's here at a little different time. The economy is a little bit stronger, but just the same. The global economy is is at least in recession. And what do you suppose Mr. Trump is going to be able to do about that? He can do some things, and he can inspire a lot of people. But there's reason to wonder whether that inspiration will be enough to overcome fundamental problems that exist. And if he can't overcome those problems, what happens to the Dow Jones Industrial Average when people realize, uh-oh, the only thing that's holding this up at record level highs is, the primary thing holding it up, is Trump's promise to do things that are wonderful. If it turns out he can't do it, what happens if we lose that confidence in Mr. Trump's ability to perform the, you know, certainly the unexpected and maybe the impossible? We lose that confidence, we can assume the Dow is going to drop. And a lot of people have been predicting it for some time. Well before we got over 21,000, they've been predicting a significant correction. And the truth of the matter is, there's not enough fundamentals to sit back, that I'm aware of, to sit back and say, no, this is the Dow will continue to rise and rise and rise. So from my perspective, you know, look at this thing from a contrarian point of view, and sit back and say, look, maybe it's time to sell out. And somebody, they're going to hit that, and perhaps soon. All right? In fact, I wouldn't be surprised that tomorrow, Thursday, we may see a significant fall. I mean, in the Dow Jones, it's over 300 points today. That's awfully good. But are we going to get 300 points tomorrow and another 300 points the day after that? I don't think so. More than likely, we'll see a correction just on the 300 points. It'll take us down below 21,000 at least. And sooner or later, we're liable to see something more significant. Here's an article that touches on that same idea from Gains, Pains, and Capitals. Is it autumn 2007 all over again? While the financial world continues to delight in Trump mania, the U.S. economy has rolled further into recession. I realize it sounds completely insane. After all, stocks are at an all-time high, and a full 61% of Americans view the economy as strong. Unfortunately, this is perception, not reality. Consider the government tax receipts, perhaps the single most objective economic metric on the planet. If the economy is growing, businesses are being started, jobs are being created, and more people and entities are paying taxes. However, if the economy isn't growing, the growth rate and this metric quickly rolls over, and what he points out is that the tax revenue is diminishing, and the implication is we're going to see reality in the near future, and we're going to face it whether we like it or not, and those of us who are holding on to the Dow Jones and believing it's going to carry us to new or more record heights are going to be seriously disappointed. Now is a good time to consider the contrarian investment strategy. I'll be back with James Corbett in about 3 minutes. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival. We will find you acting on your
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett, calling in from Japan. We have James on the program every couple of weeks, so we always look forward to it. He is. You can find James at The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. One of the best sources of podcasts, articles, videos on geopolitics to be found on the internet. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
All right. We talked to you. You almost said you can't complain there, did you?
That was my ready-made response, but yeah, I will bite my tongue.
We did that already during the break while we were waiting to start on the program. We're going to ask James what's happening in Japan relative to Fukushima, because we have heard reports here in the last week that something extraordinary has happened. The core may have disappeared. It's down someplace in the ground, and I don't know. They don't have the China syndrome in Japan. Do they have the? Where does it go if it falls all the way through the? Does it wind up?
I think
in
it
Europe
would be Brazil,
or?
Maybe.
Brazil,
like
all right.
Yeah. Something around there.
So what's happening?
Okay, so it is important to understand that. So the way that this has been reported has been, I think, part of the problem, or at least has definitely shown a lack of thinking through what is happening right now. So the best report that I could direct people to at least start to understand what some of these newer reports are about, is from a website called Simply Info. It's at fukuleaks.org. And they have a report from last month that's called No, Fukushima Daiichi Did Not See a Radiation Spike, that is talking about the way that, for example, The Guardian reported that Fukushima nuclear reactor radiation at highest level since 2011 meltdown, which is really not, strictly speaking, accurate. What is accurate is to say that the readings that the TEPCO has been able to get from the reactor are the highest readings they have seen since 2011, but it is not a radiation spike. So to be accurate in what we're talking about, the quote from the Japan Times is, the radiation level in the containment vessel of Reactor 2 at the crippled Fukushima No. 1 power plant has reached a maximum of 530 sieverts per hour, the highest since the triple core meltdown in March 2011, TEPCO said, Tokyo Electric Power Co., which owns and operates the plant, or at least did until it was nationalized. TEPCO said on Thursday that the blazing radiation reading was taken near the entrance to the space just below the pressure vessel, which contains the reactor core. The high figure indicates that some of the melted fuel that escaped the pressure vessel is nearby. So what is really being said in this report is that they have really managed to get closer to the core than they have up until this point. It's not that this is some spike or some new radiation. This is just they've never been able to get this close to the actual core itself to take readings like that. And as this Simply Info website points out, back in 2012, they did a calculation of the radiation levels that should be in that pedestal area where the core is around. We don't know exactly where it is lying, but somewhere in that area. And they were estimating that it would be 5 gigasieverts per hour in 2012, i.e. 10 times the 530 sieverts per hour that was being estimated there. And this is an estimate. That 530 sieverts per hour that they're measuring inside Reactor 2 is an estimate from radiation effects on the camera itself that was being used to explore the reactor. So what they're doing is they're taking a look at the spots on the camera, and they're using that to estimate the actual radioactivity, and that estimate comes with a 30% plus or minus variability. So it could be up in the 600 sieverts per hour, could be down to 400. Still, it's obviously extremely radioactive. It would kill people within a matter of minutes if they were exposed to it. But that is exactly what we would expect to find around the actual core of the reactor itself, which again we do know is somewhere in that area. We do not know exactly where it's lying. This is the closest they've ever gotten to it. So as a follow-up to that, TEPCO sent in a Scorpion robot that is heavily reinforced and supposed to be able to withstand something like 1,000 sieverts per hour for 2 hours or something along those lines. I can't remember the exact details, the exact specifications. They sent it in, and it died, obviously, when they started to approach wherever the reactor is lying. So that was reported as a failure, but it did actually get some real data out before it died. And the reading that it was putting out on its onboard radiation sensor was 210 sieverts per hour, which, again, is about half of what they were estimating from that earlier camera estimate that they made. So, again, what this really indicates is they're getting closer to the actual core itself. Again, this is exactly, I mean, we would expect the cores are obviously extremely radioactive. So they are just basically getting closer to actually detecting that. It's not that this is new, per se. It's not that this is a spike in radiation. It's just that they are actually approaching the cores, perhaps for the first time.
Some of the reports I've seen, they certainly didn't report it the way I'm understanding it from you. It was allegedly a spike, and oh my gosh, the world is coming to an end, and so on, and it's reassuring to find out that maybe that's not the case. How much radiation do you think is actually reaching the west coast of the United States and South America and Canada and so on?
Well, we can only go by the actual readings that people are getting, and as people saw, there was a story late last year, I believe it was, where they were getting detectable, discernible traces of Fukushima on the west coast of the United States. It was, I believe, cesium-134 that they were using as the fingerprint of Fukushima, the only possible source of cesium-134. I believe that was the right isotope of cesium. I have to relook that up. But the only possible source of that would have been Fukushima, because it has a relatively short half-life. This isn't from, you know, atomic nuclear testing 50 years ago or anything of that sort. It is from Fukushima. It was detectable and was detected, I believe late last year was when we started seeing those definitive results. But the amounts that were being detected, again, were trace amounts that would be extremely difficult to even detect, let alone to detect the effects of. And this is where you get into the debate about, I mean, is there any acceptable amount of radiation whatsoever that will not affect the human body? And the answer, scientifically speaking, as has been the scientific consensus for some time now, even by the international panels that are set up and heavily invested in, or heavily tied to the nuclear industries that have an obvious investment in covering this sort of thing up. But the real scientific consensus is that there is no safe levels of radiation. Even tiny microscopic amounts do have an effect on causing cancer, for example. But having said that, what we're seeing or what has been detected is not the kind of thing that's going to cause millions of people to die or anything of that sort, at least not yet. And to be fair, until such time as the cores actually get into the groundwater in Japan or some really game-changing event takes place, one would not expect that. Again, the highest levels of radioactivity that have been found and the deadly, instantly deadly levels of radioactivity are inside the reactor vessels themselves. The pressure vessel, anyway, of the reactors. So it is, again, everyone has to make their own determinations and what is acceptable to them. There is detectable amounts of Fukushima radiation that has reached the west coast of the United States. And again, I think people have to take unto their own, use their own calculus to decide what that means for them. But I do not think this is, you know, death of the oceans as we know it, as is sometimes portrayed in the clickbait media.
We see reports of whales washing up on the shore, dolphins, fish, whatever. Allegedly, the fauna is, I don't even know if it's fauna only on the earth, or is it also, we find fauna in the oceans as well as on the earth, meaning animals, or do you know the definition?
It's a good question. I don't know. I think
fauna is probably only on the land, but I don't know for sure. But nevertheless, question is, the reports that we've heard that the ocean is having serious problems, you're suggesting they're exaggerated and perhaps inaccurate.
Well, let's look at an specific example, and I think that's the only way we can or should be doing this, is looking at specific examples or specific assertions that this is because of this, because correlation, of course, does not equal causation. So just because something has happened in a similar time frame does not mean that it is because of this other thing that happened in a similar time frame. So we have to evaluate each claim on its own merits. And one that I go back to is a story that broke back in 2013. There was a mass starfish die-off in the Pacific, in British Columbia. And at the time, there was a lot of people that were quick to say, this is Fukushima, this is the effects of Fukushima. It was subsequently diagnosed as starfish wasting syndrome, which there are a number of different reasons why it would not be directly tied to Fukushima, but perhaps the most important one is that the first report on this was released in 2009, and their data was collected in 2008, which of course is 3 years before Fukushima melted down. So again, I think people are very quick to take any specific event and say it's Fukushima without actually seeing the causation or demonstrating that causational factor. I'm not saying that that cannot be the case. I'm not saying that it is not the case. But I think for each and every claim, we actually have to look at the causal mechanism and what's happening rather than just jumping to conclusions, especially because it's, I think, part of that phenomenon where because people are looking for something like mass die-off events, oh, okay, now every mass die-off event becomes a big headline story because you can now tie it to Fukushima because correlation is causation. So I think it's one of those things. You'll tend to see that, I think, popping up in news stories and cycles where you remember a couple of years ago there was the mass banker die-off where yep, there were the bankers yep, that were committing suicide and ending up dead in various ways. And, of course, people were very quick at the time to say, oh, this is clearly, you know, there's something going on and they're being killed or whatever. And, again, maybe that was the case, but there was really no way to show that. And it was, I think, again, the case every time a banker dies, suddenly it became big headline news because, oh, another banker died. And again, when the media picks up on a meme like that, I think they help to propagate the conception of that by reporting on each individual case, where in other time periods, like right now, if a banker died tomorrow, it would not necessarily be headline news because no one's concentrating on that story.
Does this mean I can cancel my reservation to fly to Mars with Elon Musk? The world is going to last a little longer?
Well, I wouldn't cancel the reservation, but maybe you don't have to go because you're afraid of the ocean die-off. I'm not definitively saying anything here. Hey, I mean, look, I'm not a scientist, so I'm not speaking from any scientific authority, surely. But having said that, again, I think people need to put in the research before they start panicking about these things, because there is a clear and obvious benefit for certain sectors of the media, including the independent media, to gain a lot of attention and clicks and excitement by
sky is falling.
Yeah, sky is falling. Exactly.
The Chicken Little, he's the mascot of the fake news, I think. Sky is falling, so you better read this publication. I'm encouraged a little bit by what we see in Chernobyl, a little bit I know about it. I've seen reports on it. I've watched it from time to time. Chernobyl, terrible radiation problem, and yet it's not absolutely, it didn't wipe out all life close by. there are allegedly wolves, and I don't know what other animals are apparently doing well, although maybe more mutations than usual, but Chernobyl suggests to me that radiation may not be as dangerous as a lot of people suppose. Do you think that's unwise for me to think that, or do you think that's that may be true?
Well, certainly the most dire predictions about Chernobyl and the Chernobyl area have proven not to be the case. And as you say, let's put it this way. I certainly don't cite National Geographic as the source of information, but as they say in the subhead to an article that they had about Chernobyl 30 years later, they said, it's not certain how radiation is affecting wildlife, but it is clear that animals abound. And I think that is the point. There is an active wildlife population, moose, deer, beaver, and other exotic animals that live in the Chernobyl area, which is certainly not what was being predicted by the most doomsayers of the crowd in the wake of the Chernobyl disaster. And I live just a short Shinkansen ride, a short bullet train ride from Hiroshima, where at that time there was very big questions about whether anything would ever grow again in that area because of the nuclear blasts and all of that. Uh-huh. And you know, if you go there today, other than the Peace Memorial Park where they preserve that particular building, I can't remember what it's called, this bank building, and it's got the dome and it's blown out and they've preserved it in the state that it was in. But other than that, you would not know that Hiroshima had ever been bombed. It's a thriving, bustling city with plant life and everything and animals and what have you. So, so I think the biggest, doomsday scenario purveyors have been wrong. I wouldn't say that necessarily means everything is peachy keen, but it certainly should give us pause for thought about these types of disaster stories, which, again, there are people who profit from just by being the Chicken Littles. But there's a potentially much bigger story here, which is the demonization of the nuclear industry itself by potentially the very economic interests that are most hurt by it, i.e. the natural gas and oil and other interests that have been known to be behind some of these groups that are the biggest voices against nuclear energy. And I don't certainly vouch for this or anything, but you can watch on YouTube. I can't remember the name. It would very much help if I could remember the name, but there is a researcher who gave a talk about nuclear power a couple of decades ago, and he was talking about how it's been blown out of proportion on purpose by the fossil fuel industry to make fossil fuels seem like the only possible alternative. And he was eating radioactive materials in the lecture to show, you know, it's not what people claim it to be. Again, I'm not vouching for this as dogma, but I am saying that there are other reasons why the nuclear energy industry has been so vilified, potentially.
Yeah, one more for you. We've got about a little more than 30 seconds left, but you mentioned that the Fukushima plant has been nationalized. Does that mean the taxpayers are on the hook for the repairs as opposed to TEPCO?
TEPCO was bought out to the extent that the Japanese government became the largest single shareholder of the company. Now, this doesn't mean that the Japanese government technically owns the power plant itself. It's just that they are the largest shareholder in TEPCO, and that was a few years ago. I don't actually know if they've divested themselves of that or what have you, but certainly the Japanese public are on the hook for the effects of Fukushima, and they've since revised into the, I can't remember the exact figure, but it's going to be tens of billions of dollars now committed to the clean.
That's the way it always is, isn't it? The taxpayers always get to pay. They don't necessarily get the benefits, but they definitely get the bills. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. I'll be back with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com in just a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold. gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with our guest, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We're going to talk a little about Bitcoin, which, and I don't own any Bitcoin, but James does, so he is certainly more knowledgeable about the subject than I am. I have a couple of headlines here, where one of them complains that observes that Bitcoin is extremely volatile. All right. There's another one that says worldwide. There's a worldwide phenomena where bankers hate Bitcoin, but they're still curious about blockchain. And let's talk about that just to begin. How is Bitcoin a good investment right now, or is it more of a speculation and a gamble?
It is definitely a speculation and a gamble. Because there is absolutely no guarantee with it in any sense. And I would definitely echo those sentiments that Bitcoin is nothing if not volatile. You can see dramatic rises and falls in very short periods of time, sometimes $100 in a single day, up or down. And certainly over the last 6 months, we've seen an incredible rise from $400 per Bitcoin to edging over $1,200 as we speak. So there has been an incredible degree of volatility. And it is not always apparent to me exactly what accounts for the volatility on any given day. It doesn't seem to be driven by news per se. There seems to be mysterious forces behind it. And I think part of that is because it is still a relatively small market. The market cap of Bitcoin is still under $20 billion, which is not insignificant, but it is on the global scheme of international currencies, it's absolutely minuscule. So it certainly can and is dominated, I'm sure, by some very large players who are able to influence things up or down with large transactions.
It can be manipulated without too much trouble, is what you're saying on this, just because the money is the total capitalization is so small that a big player can come in and make it go up or make it go down, and perhaps profit significantly by that manipulation.
That is correct. And in fact, we do know that the whoever or whatever created Bitcoin that went by the name Satoshi Nakamoto, and no one knows who or what that is, or whether it was a single person or a group of people or what have you, but we do know that they have a significant holding. I don't know what that is estimated at in today's price of Bitcoin, but it was certainly in the millions, tens of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin is sitting there being held. And Bitcoin being Bitcoin, with the blockchain ledger being an open source distributed ledger that is viewable by anyone, and all transactions on the blockchain are viewable, people know that these accounts are associated with that Satoshi Nakamoto, and the Bitcoin isn't being spent. You can check that. It is sitting there. But that's one example of someone who has a significant amount of Bitcoin that could make it a significant move. But then again, as I say, the blockchain being what it is and everyone being able to observe the transactions, if Satoshi Nakamoto started buying or spending Bitcoin from that address, you would be able to see it and observe it. And that would be a significant move because everyone wants to know. It's just the human interest story of it, if nothing else. You know, who is this person who invented this? It's still not something that is public knowledge.
It's kind of like Henry Ford in terms of something as revolutionary as the assembly line. Certainly going to make hard to know where this is going to go, but there's no getting around the wave. There is a wave here, and I'm sure a lot of people in the audience are wondering, can you surf this wave? And if so, which, you know, where is it safe to surf, and when is it too late?
I think you're right to point out, I mean, it is actually a technological advance that is much more important than a lot of people realize, I think, in the sense of the problems that it solves, problems that have been around for quite a long time that were solved quite elegantly. And I'll have to take people's word for this, because I'm not a mathematician. So I can look at the original Bitcoin white paper and kind of understand the general concepts, but I'm not familiar with the crypto mathematics behind it all. But it is a genuine question that people have thought about for some time. How can you have a distributed open source ledger that has no central authority, there is no central trust or verification, it's a trustless system, and yet it is able to function without that central authority? How can you do that when there are different people in different parts of the globe that are sending Bitcoin back and forth? How do you get across, for example, the double spend problem? Because in any centralized system, if somebody makes a transaction out of one account, then a central authority can stamp that and say, okay, that there it is, there's the approval, and now that account has less money, and then there's another transaction that comes in from that same account. Okay, no, there's not enough money to pay for that from that account, so I deny it. But when it's distributed like this, you could theoretically have the problem of a double spend, where someone spends their Bitcoin from their account and spends it again, but since there's no central authority that's verifying it, that could be processed before it's found out to be a double spend from that account. How do you get across that? And it has to do with the way that the network functions and all of this and the crypto mathematics behind it. It's an incredibly detailed and sort of elegant way to solve those types of problems. And as such, it is revolutionary in a number of senses. And as such, it's also important to remember that the blockchain idea and that distributed ledger that underlies the Bitcoin network is itself a different idea than Bitcoin. Blockchain does not equal Bitcoin. Bitcoin is just one network that can be constructed on a blockchain technology, which is exactly what the governments and the central banks are now looking at, and private corporations and big banks are now looking at. They're all looking at this blockchain idea. Oh, here's this elegant distributed ledger that we can use. We can create our own kind of private blockchain, private Bitcoin, if you will, not Bitcoin, but a private version of that we use to transact amongst ourselves, because it's instantaneous and there's no fees involved. It's not that big infrastructure that's been set up for transactions around the world. We can take advantage of that, and I'm going to guess they're not going to pass those savings on to customers, and it's not going to benefit anyone except the big banks, the central banks, the big players that are looking at capitalizing on this technology. The other side of that is, like anything else, they want to suppress the competition. And that means, in this case, suppress Bitcoin. And that's why we see the regulations coming in all around the world. Japan is about to pass some new regulations for Bitcoin this April. In fact, they have passed them. It's just they're going to kick into effect in April. The Philippines Central Bank just issued a circular with a raft of new regulatory requirements for exchanges. The Australian Digital Currency and Commerce Association has come up with their own self-regulatory code of conduct to kind of, you know, preempt the Australian government, which is obviously going to crack down at some point. So they're, no, we'll crack down on ourselves. It's okay. And of course, China, I think most famously, has been in the last couple of months coming through with a lot of what's been rumored for a while, which is a general crackdown on Bitcoin. The three largest Bitcoin exchanges in China have all voluntarily suspended withdrawals for a month in order to upgrade their equipment to comply with new anti-money laundering efforts by the Chinese government. And then nine other exchanges have admitted to having behind closed doors talks with the People Bank of China, where they discussed risk and problems in the Bitcoin market, i.e. the People's Bank of China said, continue doing what you're doing and we'll kill you. So I think definitely the Bitcoin clampdown is happening in China. And lo and behold, simultaneously, the People's Bank of China is announcing that they've done successful completions on their own private blockchain that they've constructed, where they're starting to basically lay the framework for what they are now promising is going to be a digital version of the yuan, a completely government-controlled digital currency that they're going to be starting to roll out sometime in the future. They don't say when, months, years, maybe decades, but at any rate, they are working on it right now. And I think it's two sides of the coin. They've got a crackdown on Bitcoin, and then they're building up their own version of that private infrastructure behind closed doors.
I have no doubt that the New World Order, One World Government, the whole idea is ultimately based on a single global currency. They are emulating Baron Rothschild's observation where he said, I don't care who makes the laws as long as I can control the money. And I think the governments of the world understand the truth of that statement, a profound truth. We can, a lot of people look at that and just, oh, that was, isn't that interesting? No, it's not interesting. It's way beyond that. If you can control the money, you really can control the world. And if you intend to control the world, you've got to control the money. Is it possible that a privatized entity like Bitcoin could actually threaten the global banking system by creating a viable alternative to the currency issued by central banks? Is that possible, or is that just, again, maybe can they expect to have their lives threatened before it gets to that point?
Yeah, well, I guess that depends how we parse the word possible, because is it possible theoretically, or is it possible politically? I think that it's being demonstrated right now that it is not possible politically, because of course governments like China and Japan and the Philippines and Australia and the U.S. and everywhere else are starting to pass their laws to clamp down on Bitcoin in various ways. And to be fair, I should stress that it's impossible really to stop the idea of Bitcoin. As long as people can trade strings of numbers and letters on the internet, Bitcoin will survive. In fact, you don't even need the internet for it. You could run the Bitcoin network on paper. It would be very cumbersome. It would involve mailing things back and forth to people, but the concept would be the same, and it would still be possible. So that, I don't think it's really possible for a government to suppress it, but they clamp down on those points that interface with that fiat currency system. So the exchanges where you go and you take your U.S. dollars and you buy Bitcoin, or you take your Bitcoin and sell them for U.S. dollars, the exchanges is where the clampdown happens. And of course, exchanges are now beholden to all the money laundering rules and know your customer and everything else. So you have to verify yourself six ways from Sunday and give your blood and, pledge your children and all of that, whatever else, they make you do to get signed up for those. So I think that's where the clampdown is coming.
What about the Bitcoin without, I know that some entities, retail markets and whatever, and they're selling their products for Bitcoins, which implies that there's no need to change your Bitcoin into dollars in order to purchase something. I don't doubt there are a lot of things, probably most things you want, you need dollars to purchase them, at least here in the United States. Bitcoin is only a small, competitor, but even if they close down the point where you can change Bitcoin into dollars, what about the point where you can change Bitcoin into a new automobile?
Exactly right. Yes, again.
Now what? Can they control that? Can that be stopped?
It's in a lot of ways analogous to the problems, quote unquote, with cash, i.e. problems from the perspective of controllers. If you want to go out and give someone a bundle of paper for, this car or whatever it is, the government doesn't necessarily have a way to see that transaction, and it can be done under the table. Now, obviously, most businesses are operating in a way that, there will be a paper trail and receipts and all of that, and it'll be done above board because there are so many regulations, and it would be illegal to do it without the proper, payment of the pound of the flesh to the taxpayer and all of the tax collector and all of that. But Having said that, it is certainly possible that, and it is happening, that people transact in Bitcoin rather than going through an exchange. There are other ways, for example, even if you do want to exchange dollars for Bitcoin or vice versa, there are sites like Local Bitcoins where you can arrange to meet up with someone in person, face-to-face, if you want to, and you send them Bitcoin and they'll hand you some cash. And again, obviously, there have been people who have been arrested for doing things like that because, you know, the government needs their pound of flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to, and that's, you know, money laundering or whatever, but it does go on. And so I think it's a similar thing. Major retailers that accept Bitcoin will do so in a way that, again, there's a paper trail and, you know, the tax gets paid and all of that. But there will always be those cracks in the system. And speaking of cracks, there's something called Open Bazaar, which is a kind of Silk Road. Maybe you heard of Silk Road?
I have. In fact, I looked at Open Bazaar just in the last week or so. And today it was in, it just began to go across my radar, and I took a look at it. And go ahead and describe it.
It's a peer-to-peer exchange system that, again, there's no central point, so it cannot be shut down. It's just, it exists as on the internet, and people connect peer-to-peer. So you can sign up and you can sell anything. I don't think you have to sign up. In fact, you just sell something via that network, and someone else can buy it, and you can exchange in whatever you want, including Bitcoin or whatever else. And if you use all of the privacy protection and blah, 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 and 7 proxies and Tor network and whatever else, at least theoretically, you can do all of that anonymously. So again, there's no way to shut down Open Bazaar itself because there's no central point to shut down. That's the future of the black market, the gray market, the market that the government can't necessarily regulate or control. Again, they'll have to work on de-anonymizing people and finding out who they are and punishing them for not, you didn't pay your taxes.
They'll make a real example,
exactly,
of the ones they catch. The first ones they catch, they're going to be brutalized.
Exactly,
you're
gonna
do
like
something
the Silk
trivial.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're going to make it clear. Don't let us catch any of the rest of you doing this because we'll destroy your lives.
Exactly.
They are bound and determined to protect the existing monetary system, and this whole technology threatens it deeply. And you have to wonder, I don't know, can the banking system survive this? Can they really stop this? We've only got about 15 seconds left, but can they control this, or is this an idea whose time has come and is too powerful to be resisted for long?
If people want it, it's already here. The bankers, the middlemen have been eliminated, technologically speaking. It's just a question of pushing that through to its conclusion and whether people have the political will to do so.
All right, James, thanks very much for being on the program. Thanks for your insight and your comments. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you and me and Melody, James, and Tob, our producer. Good night.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.